everyone. I'm Eric Carlson from SUNY ESF, here with the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project. I'm a master's student. I'm very happy to be here to represent the project and talk to you about how we're using biotechnology to restore the American chestnut to its former glory. I'm a part of a very large team of graduate students and volunteers, undergraduate researchers, and other researchers, and this project goes back about 30 years, so there's quite a bit of research to cover. So the American chestnut at one time was very important for wood products. It had good straight-grained wood that was rot-resistant. Agriculturally, it was good for feeding your animals, as well as milling to turn into flour for different baking goods, as well as making beer and other various things. Socially and historically, it was very important, as is reflected in many old popular songs and rhymes, and as well as on many different street signs across the nation. As a keystone forest species, American chestnut supported many different animal species, ranging from insects to birds, fish, large mammals. So what happened? Chestnut blight arrived from Asia on Japanese chestnuts. You can see it there smiling at you, Cryphonaxia parasitica. This fungus on Asian chestnuts is a saprophyte, which means that it will not kill the tree. It will wait until it dies before it consumes the dead wood. Due to evolutionary history with Asian chestnuts, they are resistant to this fungus. But when it came to America and made the short jump to American chestnut, which has no shared evolutionary history with the fungus, the tree quickly succumbed to the fungus. So from the initial point of infection, the fungus secretes oxalic acid into the tissue, which will kill the tissue, which the fungus then grows into and consumes, then repeats the cycle, releasing oxalic acid, killing the tissue, and forming a canker. Eventually, the canker will wrap around the stem and girdle the tree and kill everything above the canker. And then sequential cankers will form down the tree, killing it to the ground. The disease spread very fast once it was initially discovered in 1904, and being that American chestnuts made up one in four of every tree in the eastern forest, it was quite an apocalyptic scene, with a quarter of all the trees in the American forest dying. It's actually the most devastating forest pathogen in known history. So from the initial infection in 1904 discovered in the Bronx, it spread throughout the entire American chestnut range, killing about 4 billion trees in 50 years. Then made a jump from the American chestnut to its close relative, the chinkapin, which then quickly succumbed to the same fate as the American chestnut, reaching near extinction levels, which they are both at now. It's important to note that, like Asian chestnuts, oak can harbor Cryphonaxia parasitica without any illness, which means that there's a natural reservoir of the pathogen that will continuously be in the forest forever. So even if American chestnut was completely wiped out, the pathogen would remain in the forest. Today, the American chestnut survives in its roots. The fungus will kill the tree down to the ground. However, the fungus cannot persist in the soil due to the microbiota that are present that can outcompete the fungus. So a tree can die down to the ground, but the roots will sprout new shoots out the stumps. These shoots can grow up to 7 feet in 1 year. Some can survive several years and even go on to flower and produce chestnuts, but eventually they will become reinfected and die down to the ground and repeat the cycle, the Sisyphus-like cycle of pushing that boulder up the hill only to have it crash down on you for all eternity. So what was once a great chestnut forest ranging from Georgia to Maine, where one in four of these trees would have been an American chestnut, has now been reduced to few survivors that can be spotted pretty easily in spring by their prolific white flowering. So if Asian chestnuts are resistant to the blight and they can cross with American, then why don't we just create hybrids to replace the American chestnut? Well, the Chinese chestnut and the American chestnut are two very different species of trees. The Chinese chestnut has been bred for thousands of years to take on orchard-like qualities to produce a good nut crop reliably in an orchard setting. It can't compete in a forest. It can't grow into a canopy and compete with tulip poplars and maples like the American chestnut can. A good way to think about it is if you cross a lion and a tiger, you can produce ligers, which are fertile and they can breed. But you would never be able to replace a lion or a tiger with a liger in the natural environment because they've lost their adaptations that have been honed for millennia in those single species. So in a similar way, a hybrid's unlikely to be able to replace an American chestnut in the wild. There are better ways. The American Chestnut Foundation has a 30-year backcross breeding program that's now on its sixth generation. They complete a hybrid cross and then successive backcrossing events. So from the initial hybridization of the American and the Chinese, they backcross with American, and in each sequential generation, they select for resistance from the Asian chestnut, while at the same time selecting out the unwanted orchard traits that come along with the Asian chestnut. So after 30 years, they've got their sixth generation called B3F3, which is 1/16th Chinese, which might not seem like much, but in the next slide you'll see that's a pretty large change to a genome. So what if you didn't have to select out any of these traits along the way? The American chestnut has 38,000 gene pairs. If you were to equate those to words in a book, that would equal about 180 pages. If 1/16th of those words were in Chinese, that would equate to about 10 pages or 2,375 words. So while you might be able to still read the book and get a good gist of what's going on, those words might be someplace like an important plot twist that could make it very confusing, might not quite fit just right. So for example, Henry David Thoreau's book, who is a very big American chestnut fan, he said, "It was very exciting at that season to roam the then boundless chestnut woods of Lincoln." Using a transgenic approach, we're inserting two genes into the genome. And if you were to add two words to this book in the right place, it might become the then boundless, blight-resistant chestnut woods of Lincoln. And this way you can kind of see the scale of change between the two different approaches, 2,375 words or two. So what we have is a 100% American chestnut plus blight resistance. The gene that we use is called oxalate oxidase from wheat. What this gene does, and its protein, is it breaks oxalic acid, as I mentioned to you before, the weapon of the fungus, down into hydrogen peroxide and CO2, which are actually beneficial to the plant and are actually used in immune responses. This is not a pesticide, so the gene and its protein do not kill the fungus. There's no cidal activity. What we're doing is we're stripping the weapon away from the fungus. And what that does is it prevents resistance from forming in the fungus. If you think about it as antibiotic resistance, if you throw an antibiotic at a colony of bacteria, there might be a few individuals in there that are resistant, and then those can get amplified in the population and quickly become resistant. By not killing the fungus, we are returning it to the saprophytic lifestyle that it came in on the Asian chestnut, and as it is on oak. So we're putting the American chestnut back to where it was before the blight got here. Oxalate oxidase, while we're getting it from wheat, it's found in many, many different types of plants, many that we eat already on a daily basis, such as wheat, rice, barley, banana, peanut, but also, and very importantly, it's found in the American chestnut's natural environment. It's found in goat grass and brome, castor, several mosses and fungi. It's essentially a ubiquitous enzyme in most environments. So how do we get the gene in? We use the tried and true method of agrobacterium-mediated transformation. And once we have our transformants, we must regenerate whole plants from single cells. And that process is how to make a tree from the seed the hard way, and it is a hard way to do it. We first isolate embryos from immature chestnuts. So we take our American chestnut, and it's pollinated, and we harvest the chestnuts at a very early stage. As you can see in the bottom right there, peeling it open, you see that white nut. It's very immature. You can dissect the chestnut, and you see the little embryos at the top. We can take those embryos, place them into embryo multiplication culture, as you see on the left. Those embryos will begin dividing and forming an embryo cluster that looks a lot like that. We've actually maintained several cultures for more than 9 years, probably about 12 or 13 years at this point. We take that cluster and we do just a classic agrobacterium transformation. We put the cluster into an agrobacterium solution, let it rotate for a few hours, and then we, and this is the important part, put it into a bioreactor on a desiccation plate. Inside the bioreactor, there's selection media that comes up and floods that cluster periodically throughout the day. And what that does is it kills the embryos that have not been transformed with our marker gene, NPT2. And what we're left with are transformed embryos. This is a cluster of embryos that are transformed with GFP, which this picture was taken early on in the research stages of us figuring out how to use it. We don't actually use GFP in our events. But you can see each of those little dots in those clusters is an individual transformed cell. Now, due to the random nature of agrobacterium insertions, every single one of those cells is a separate event, and they'll have a separate insertion in the genome. So, for example, this event 1 may have an insertion on this chromosome. And then this event over here might have an insertion on that chromosome. And these positions have important implications on the expression level of the gene. So we've created a wide array of events, ranging from the zero expression, which is our LS1 non-transgenic control, to our SX311, which is our lead research event, which expresses at a very high level. You can see that the arrow on the right, that's the level of expression that approaches the resistance that Asian chestnut has to the blight. And the SX311, we're not using that for our lead event for the regulatory matters because it does have GFP, but that's about the level of expression that we're using in our lead events that we're going to be putting through government regulatory approval. And the resistance of the transgenic lines that express at that level actually surpasses that of Asian chestnut. So once you have your transformed embryos, you need to put them through the tissue culture process to grow adult plants. You move from the cluster of embryos to the cotyledon stage, to the shoot formation stage, and then from shoots, you put them into multiplication media. Once they're in multiplication media, they're ready for rooting. We do not root in gel, we root ex vitro. So you can see these shoots don't have roots on them. We remove them from the gel and cut off the bottoms and dip them in rooting media and then place them into peat pellets, into rubber containers for them to sprout roots, which we then move into tree tubes with soil and begin acclimating them to field conditions. We move the tree tubes from growth chambers to greenhouse to field. So how do we test for blight resistance? We have several different assays we use, but the final and conclusive assay is the small stem assay, where we put uniform holes into the stems, and then into those holes we place uniform plugs of fungal culture. You can see on the left is the non-transgenic American control. After 6 weeks, has died all the way down the ground. You see it's resprouted out the bottom. The Asian resistant control on the right is actually half of those have still wilted. So while they do have resistance, they still do succumb to the blight at times. And in the center, you see our darling 54 lead event that has full resistance, actually surpassing Asian chestnut, growing as normal after 6 weeks of inoculation. Now that we have our lead events, we need to produce many transgenic nuts. And the way to do that is to place our young trees into highlight growth chambers. The highlight growth chambers force male flowering, from which we collect pollen, and take to our designated field plots with mother trees that are old enough to produce female flowers. We then take our transgenic pollen, pollinate our mother trees, and then they put out 50% transgenic chestnuts. Due to the hemizygous nature of agrobacterium insertion, it means that 50% of offspring will inherit the gene. So you see here, this is an offspring of a transgenic pollination. This is one of the 50% that did not inherit the gene. And after a stem inoculation, you can see it has become completely cankered and split up and began to die. Here's its sibling that inherited the gene. You can see there's almost no cankering. There's a little bit of growth along the border, which means that the blight is still alive, but it's not going to kill the tree. And here's a side profile of that. We're not going to patent these trees. This is a not-for-profit project. Our goal is to provide blight-resistant trees so that the species can be restored to the forest. We're not trying to make money off it. We want the American chestnut to reclaim its place in the forest as it used to be. But first, we need to go through government regulatory approval through the USDA, FDA, and the EPA. Since this is the first project to ever use transgenic trees for a restoration, it's a new paradigm, so it'll probably take around 2 to 4 years for the government to sort through everything they need to do to make sure we're good to go. So these are a list of comparison studies we've already completed to assess the impact of the transgene, including leaf litter and insect feeding. We've also done studies on soil mycorrhizae, wood frog tadpoles that feed on leaf litter in vernal pools, and pollinators, and we found no impact of the transgene in any of these experiments. No negative impact. We're left with a unique opportunity to go out into the wild once we've given government approval and begin pollinating those surviving trees to rescue their cytoplasmic genetic diversity. In addition, we have diversity plots that have trees that are grown from chestnuts throughout that are nuts that are collected throughout the American chestnut range, so that we can create transgenic crosses with them to send back to where they came from so they can be used to create more transgenic trees for them to plant in their locally adapted areas. We've also created a rapid test to determine whether or not the transgene has been inherited. You can see on the right, those black borders are due to the reaction of oxo with oxalate in a test solution, whereas on the left, there's no reaction, meaning no inherited transgene. That's everything, and I'll be happy to take any questions.